wondering who can be bought. Some might find they're cheaper and some stronger than they thought. Well, I'll stand or fall right here in my country, in my home. I used to think that I was alone. Well, I ain't alone no more. A black Spartacus heart attack machine. A black Spartacus heart attack machine. A black Spartacus heart attack machine. Go!
Black Spartacus heart attack machine by Tom Morello in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Today, New York City Democrats are voting in an historic mayoral primary. For much of the race, the 67-year-old former governor, Andrew Cuomo, was seen as the clear frontrunner. Cuomo resigned 4 years ago over allegations he sexually harassed at least 11 women while in office. But polls show the race has become extremely tight. The possible new frontrunner, according to some polls, is a 33-year-old Democratic Socialist State Assembly member, Zohran Mamdani. He's risen to the top tier of a crowded field of 11 candidates in which voters will use a ranked choice voting system to choose five candidates in order of their preference. A coalition of progressive groups has called on voters to not rank Cuomo. Last October, Mamdani joined Democracy Now! As he launched his mayoral campaign and laid out the platform he's now known for. Today, he joins us on the phone from the campaign trail for a few minutes before we look broadly at this historic race. Zohran Mamdani, welcome back to Democracy Now! You held a news conference this morning in your home district of Astoria at sunrise?
Yes, yes, I did, because that's the time that many New Yorkers are getting up to go to work, so they deserve a mayor who'll be ready just like they are.
And so talk about what your message is today and how you think it is that you have eaten into something like a 40% lead that the disgraced former governor Andrew Cuomo had, and now some polls are putting you ahead.
Well, Amy, it's the same message that we've had since we launched this campaign on October 23rd, 8 months ago. And it was such a pleasure to do so at Democracy Now! And sharing our vision for a city that New Yorkers can actually afford. Affordability is the crisis of the five boroughs across our city, where we live in the wealthiest city in the wealthiest country in the history of the world, and yet one in four New Yorkers are living in poverty. 500,000 children are going to sleep hungry every night, and the rest are in a permanent state of anxiety as to whether they can continue to afford to pay their rent, to pay their childcare, to even afford the cost of groceries. And ultimately, what has powered our campaign's rise from 1% in the polls to being just a hair's breadth away from City Hall is this focus on an economic agenda that will deliver a New York City that working and middle-class New Yorkers can actually afford.
And how have you been able to build such a large campaign apparatus, despite the fact that most of the, quote, establishment Democratic operatives, the unions and the political leaders have not backed you?
You know, I think it's been incredible to see how the very New Yorkers who've been left behind by the politics of our city and of today have been the ones that are powering our campaign's rise. And I now speak to you with more than 50,000 volunteers. There was a point at the beginning of this race where there were some that doubted whether we would receive even 50,000 votes. And yet this campaign apparatus, of which I cannot think of a precedent in our city, is one that has now knocked on 1.5 million doors, made more than 500,000 phone calls, and ultimately is carrying a belief in politics that should require no translation, a politics that speaks directly to working and middle-class New Yorker struggles, and one that so often is being shared directly by one New Yorker to another at a doorstep or a subway platform or in a park, because too often we've allowed politics to become something where we wait for New Yorkers to come to us, or we lecture them instead of listen to them. And what we have done instead is reach out to New Yorkers wherever they are across these five boroughs.
And of course, this is the Democratic primary that we're dealing with today. And it looks like the general election in November will be a lot different as well, given the fact that even Andrew Cuomo, if he were not to prevail, is going to run as an independent, that the current mayor, Eric Adams, is also running as an independent. Do you see this as, if you prevail today, to be a guarantee of victory, or you have a lot more campaigning to do in the months ahead?
We got here by never taking any day for granted, and that's how we're going to run the rest of this race. And we're confident that we'll win the primary, and then we'll run the general in the same manner, just as hungry as New Yorkers are for a new city, a city that takes care of each and every person. And ultimately, I've been running against Eric Adams' second term from the beginning of this race, and Andrew Cuomo is running for that same term. It's the same corruption, the same donors, the same limited vision, funded by the very corporations that are benefiting from this inequality crisis in the city. And we are on the brink of defeating that second term in the primary, and we'll do it again in the general.
I wanted to ask you about the New York Times saying they weren't going to endorse anyone in this primary and then went after you. They said, "We do not believe Mr. Mamdani deserves a spot on New Yorkers' ballots. His experience is too thin. His agenda reads like a turbocharged version of Mr. de Blasio's dismaying mayoralty. As for Mr. Cuomo, we have serious objections to his ethics and conduct, even if he would be better for New York's future than Mr. Mamdani." They went after you about controlling rent. They went after you about grocery stores. Talk about what you have promised New Yorkers on all of these issues and why you think the Times is wrong. And do you actually think them going after you helps you?
You know, I think that their opinions are those of, you know, about a dozen New Yorkers, and they certainly have the right to it. And this is an election that will be decided by closer to a million New Yorkers. And ultimately, I was proud that when the New York Times assembled a panel of experts, they rated our campaign. It came to House of Life. And those are two of the issues at the forefront of most New Yorkers' minds in this election. And ultimately, our platform has been one laser focused on that economic agenda in our promises to freeze the rent for more than 2 million rent stabilized tenants, to make the slowest buses in the country fast and free, and to deliver universal child care. Because ultimately, these are the ways in which city government can make life that little bit easier for each and every New Yorker, and finally own up to the tools that it already has, as opposed to pretend that it is merely a spectator in a suffocating cost of living crisis.
And finally, in about a minute that we have left, the last few mayoral Democratic primaries have been marked by very low participation level. What's your sense of the turnout for this election?
I can tell you just from the early voting numbers that it is very exciting to see so many more New Yorkers participate in this process. From the beginning of this race, we've said we wanted to bring more people into our politics such that our elections look more like the city that we love. And we're seeing so many New Yorkers, be they younger New Yorkers or New Yorkers who've lived here for decades but had never registered to vote, finally seeing themselves in our politics, in our policies. And ultimately, We know the importance of this is because the democracy is not just under attack from an authoritarian administration in Washington. It's also under attack from within in a withering belief in its relevance to the struggles of everyday people. And ultimately, this race is one way in which we can show that we can actually deliver a city that New Yorkers can afford, and we can do so by building a movement the city has never seen before.
Zoran Mamdani, want to thank you for being with us. We know you're on the road on this primary day here in New York. New York mayoral candidate and New York assembly member, Zoran Mamdani, a Democratic socialist. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. To talk more about the New York mayoral race, we're joined by John Tarleton, editor-in-chief of The Independent, which is closely following New York City's mayor election. They had Zoran Mamdani on the cover of their January issue. John's recent piece is headlined, "Zoran Mamdani's Path to Victory." Earlier this month, Mamdani and Brad Lander, the other leading progressive candidate in the race, announced they would cross-endorse each other using ranked choice voting.
We both know what we need to do to save our city from Andrew Cuomo.
You want to tell him?
You go first.
Nah, you go first.
Let's do it together.
We're cross-endorsing.
In New York City, we have ranked choice voting. That means you can rank up to 5 candidates for mayor.
Brad and I are officially telling our supporters.
Rank me number one.
Rank Zoran number two.
Let's send Andrew Cuomo
back to the suburbs.
Now, this may be extremely strange for people who don't have ranked choice voting to have two adversaries endorsing each other. For more, we're joined by John Tarleton to lay it all out. Again, the editor-in-chief of The Independent. You just heard, before we talk about ranked choice voting and the significance of these two co-endorsing each other, what that means.
Yep.
Zoran Mamdani, it sort of reminds you years ago of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who the mainstream media hardly covered when she was running against Joe Crowley, longtime Democratic Congress member in the leadership of the House of Representatives. And she beat him. The Independent, your newspaper, had her on the cover before she even won. Do you see a replay here?
I do see a lot of similarities. You have a politician from an older generation like Andrew Cuomo that I think has really underestimated Zoran Mamdani in his campaign. Cuomo is comfortable with a very sort of stale, maybe outdated form of politicking. There's been almost no grassroots ground game from the Cuomo campaign. They thought they were going to win easily, so why go around knocking on doors? Meanwhile, Mamdani's campaign has now knocked on more than 1.5 million doors and had countless conversations with ordinary voters. And also, Zoran Mamdani's platform is really, I think, speaking to a lot of people who feel like government doesn't do nearly enough to make their lives easier. And that was something that AOC was doing 7 years ago as well. I think one difference is AOC was running in one congressional district that tended to have very low voter turnout. She won that primary with 16,000 votes, and Crowley got about 12,000. In this race, we're going to have roughly 900,000 to 1 million votes cast. So Zoran, ultimately, after all the ranked choice voting sorts out, will need probably 450,000 or more votes to win. And he's certainly has a very decent chance of doing that. So he's operating on this is the biggest left sort of electoral undertaking since the Bernie presidential campaigns.
And John, I just wanted to ask you briefly about the role of the real estate industry, the landlords of New York. They're investing heavily in Andrew Cuomo, and Michael Bloomberg has tossed in money, several million dollars for Cuomo. What's your sense of why the landlords are so upset about the possibility of a Mamdani victory?
Yeah, the New York Apartment Association recently made a $2.5 million contribution to Cuomo's super PAC, which has received more than $20 million total from billionaires and major corporations. The reason the real estate industry is concerned about Zoran Mamdani, for starters, he's made freezing the rent a central part of his platform. Here in New York, we sort of have a patchwork of rent laws. I mean, going back to the 1940s, have their origins in World War II, but continue to this day, that provide what's called rent stabilization for about 950,000 apartment units, which covers about 2.4 million New Yorkers. And under the laws here, the mayor appoints all nine members of something called the Rent Guidelines Board. And that Rent Guidelines Board each year decides how much landlords, the maximum they can increase the rent on their tenants. Under Eric Adams, over the last 3 years, that Rent Guidelines Board has cumulatively increased the rent by about 9%. Under Adams' predecessor, Bill de Blasio, in 3 out of the 8 years de Blasio was mayor, he froze the rent. And Zoran Mamdani has said he will appoint a Rent Guidelines Board, all nine members he will be the one appointing, that will enact a permanent rent freeze for as long as he's mayor. So that's certainly one reason the real estate industry is concerned about Zoran.
In a moment, we're going to speak to Ro Khanna, the congressmember from Silicon Valley, who refuses to take super PAC money. But if you can finally talk about that issue we started at the beginning, just for 30 seconds before we go to Congressmember Khanna, and that is the issue of ranked choice voting. Even for New Yorkers, it's almost new, one previous election. What it means that Brad Lander and Zoran Mamdani have co-endorsed each other,
Yeah, so if the polls are anywhere near accurate, the results that come in tonight, Cuomo may be slightly ahead, and both candidates somewhere in the mid 30%, and the election will be decided when the ranked choice votes are tabulated next Tuesday, and Lander seems destined to finish in third place, and he's strongly, you know, cross-endorsed with Zora Mamdani, and the polling projections that came out yesterday from Emerson, a leading independent pollster, which showed Zoran winning the election, they showed him winning it when at the final stage of ranked choice, when Brad Lander's votes would be reallocated. So that cross-endorsement could be decisive.
To hear our extended interview with John Tarleton, you can go to democracynow.org. John Tarleton is the editor-in-chief of The Independent. We thank you so much for being with us. Next up, what's the role of Congress in starting U.S. wars? We'll speak with Congressmember Ro Khanna. Stay with us.
Khele sagal jagata
Singh in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Just hours after a fragile ceasefire between Israel and Iran begins, President Trump criticized both countries this morning, explicitly saying he's not happy with Israel. This all comes 2 days after Trump ordered U.S. attacks on three Iranian nuclear sites without seeking congressional approval. We turn now to look at the role Congress plays in starting wars. For more on this question, we're joined by Democratic Congressmember Ro Khanna, member of the House Armed Services Committee. Last week, he introduced a bipartisan Iran War Powers resolution with Republican Congressmember Thomas Massie in a bid to prevent U.S. involvement in the Iran-Israel conflict and reassert that any U.S. military action against Iran must be authorized by Congress. We want to start by asking Congressmember Khanna to respond to Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth in a press conference talking about the Trump administration fulfilling the notification requirements of the War Powers Act by notifying Congress immediately after.
They were notified after the planes were safely out, where we complied with the notification requirements of the War Powers Act.
After the attacks, they were notified.
They were immediately thereafter.
Well, for more, Congressmember Ro Khanna joins us from the Cannon Rotunda in D.C., Deputy Whip of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, member of the House Armed Services Committee. Last night, I watched an hour and a half Q&A that was a MoveOn.org event titled Fund Healthcare, Not Warfare. Ro Khanna was the main guest. Congressmember Khanna, respond to what Hegseth is saying and what you're demanding.
Well, he's just violating the Constitution. You can't, as the president, engage in strikes on a foreign country when there's no imminent threat without coming to Congress for authorization. In this case, the missile strikes were characterized as a war on Iran. That was how it was characterized in papers across our country. That's how the Iranian people felt it. And that's why Representative Massie and I introduced the bipartisan War Powers Resolution. Now, the good thing is, I think, actually, President Trump paid attention. He saw that there was a lot of revolt within his own MAGA base, people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, Steve Bannon, Tucker Carlson speaking out. And he has gotten gotten a ceasefire. Now the key is he going to make sure that the ceasefire holds? And is he actually going to engage in the kind of negotiation that President Obama engaged in to make sure that Iran doesn't develop a nuclear weapon? The danger is Iran is just going to learn the lesson of Pakistan and North Korea and take their nuclear program in a covert direction.
And Congressman, how do you react to some of your colleagues, your Republican colleagues, who say the Democrats are crying now, but when Democrats engaged in bombings without seeking congressional approval, they were silent, specifically for instance, some of the bombings that President Obama did in Yemen, the attacks on Libya and other countries?
Well, frankly, they're right. I mean, the Libya attacks were blatantly unconstitutional. Those strikes were also counterproductive. They incentivized countries to say, if you voluntarily agree to give up your nuclear program, the United States may still attack you. And the attacks on Yemen were unconstitutional. Bernie Sanders and I passed the first War Powers Resolution to stop the refueling of Saudi planes. So I have been consistent, as have a few of us, speaking out against unconstitutional strikes, whether they're Democratic or Republican presidents. The question for the Democratic Party is, are we going to take the mantle of being the anti-war party? That's not pacifism. That means against these wars of choice. The American people are desperate for that. The anti-war candidate has usually won, and Trump outflanked us in 2016 and 2024 on an anti-war platform. I am pushing my party to be very clear that we will stand against these overseas wars of choice.
And could you explain what the 1973 War Powers Resolution calls for?
Well, there are two different issues. One is the Constitution itself. And the Constitution says that before you strike another country and declare war, you need to come to Congress. The War Powers Resolution says that if there is hostility that the president has initiated, he needs to notify Congress, and then Congress can vote to stop that hostility. So it is a check that Congress has when the president acts in a way that defies congressional authorization. But what we should have in this country is not the need to use a War Powers Resolution. What we should have in this country is the president coming to Congress before they want to strike another country. And in many cases, they may actually get the authorization. Here, Donald Trump didn't want to come to Congress because he knew at least one-third of his own MAGA base was opposed to the strikes and would have debated and argued against it.
So you are co-sponsoring this resolution with the Republican Congressmember Massey. Trump aides have launched a new super PAC devoted to defeating Massey in his 2026 election. The new PAC, called Kentucky MAGA, will be run by two of Trump's top political lieutenants, his former co-campaign manager Chris LaCivita and longtime pollster Tony Fabrizio. Can you respond and also take this larger to the issue of super PACs that you have long taken on, rejecting super PAC money in your own campaign? And do you think the weapons industry are long profiting from these super PACs?
The biggest problem in American democracy is the role of big money. It has skewed our foreign policy into bloated defense budgets. It skewed our foreign policy in the Middle East. It has prevented us from getting Medicare for all. It has prevented us from taking on a big pharma and lowering prescription drug prices. It has prevented us from getting rid of fossil fuel subsidies. It is why I don't take any PAC money. It's why Summer Lee and I have a bill to outlaw super PACs that still would be constitutional under Citizens United. If you can regulate the amount of money someone can give to a candidate, why can't you regulate the amount of money someone can give to a super PAC? And what Donald Trump is doing to Thomas Massey is unconscionable. Thomas Massey is actually a profile in courage. I believe him speaking up in our War Powers Resolution helped put pressure on Donald Trump to not escalate this war further and to get a ceasefire. And the reason that Donald Trump is targeting Thomas Massey is not not just vindictiveness. When he's vindictive, he'll tweet out. He may encourage a primary challenge. Here he's putting his entire apparatus, his top political operatives, in a super PAC against Massey because he knew that other Republicans were thinking of joining that war powers resolution. He knew that he was bleeding his base, and he wanted to send a clear message, a chilling effect to the Congress not to do what Massey did. Massey got under his skin, and I'm glad that some of the Republicans spoke out so we're not escalating the war. But it is just a perversion of democracy to see these super PACs. They took out my friend Jamal Bowman, and they threatened members of Congress in undemocratic ways.
And Congressman, I wanted to ask you, all of this expanding hostilities in the Middle East come in the midst of Congress grappling with what to do about the so-called one big beautiful bill, the signature budget bill of the Trump administration. What's your sense of the impact of this continuing problems internationally on where this bill is going?
The bill is a betrayal of Trump to his base. I mean, Trump promised no more money on wars overseas, and I'm going to help support and fund the working and middle class. Instead, what is he doing? He's increasing the defense budget by $150 billion. He's spending billions of dollars on this war in Iran, and he's literally ripping health care, Medicaid, food assistance away from the working and middle class, many of them his voters. At the same time, he's giving a total handout to technology companies by banning states, all 50 states, from having any AI regulation for 10 years. This will mean no state could have regulations to protect truck drivers. It would mean no states could have regulations to protect workers against AI surveillance. No state could have regulations to protect kids against algorithmic addiction. It is a terrible bill. Tax breaks for the billionaires, handouts to corporations, huge defense increases, and hurting the working and middle class, ripping away their health care and their food assistance.
I want to play a voice from Gaza, Ro. Why not a ceasefire there? Al Jazeera is reporting that Palestinians are saying, if you're going to have a ceasefire between Israel and Iran, what about extending that to Gaza? This is a Palestinian man named Khalil Mosbeh speaking from Khan Yunis.
Whoever stopped the war between Iran and Israel is able to stop the war, which has been going on for almost 3 years in the Gaza Strip. Massacres every day, killing of children, killing the elderly, destruction of infrastructure, destruction of education, destruction of healthcare, destruction of everything we own in the Gaza Strip.
In fact, many say, Rokana, that Netanyahu launched this war on Iran to divert attention from the catastrophe that is Gaza right now. What about a ceasefire there? And how can you force that in Congress?
The report is heart-wrenching. Every time I hear about Gaza, about the over 55,000 killed, many women and children, the over 130,000 wounded, the 600,000 students who have not been able to go to school for years, the 400,000 starving. I think what a stain on the conscience, not just of our nation, but the world. It is why I voted against the offensive funding to Netanyahu almost 7 months ago. Now, look, I was encouraged that President Trump this morning finally said no to Netanyahu on a bombing in Iran. But he needs to say no to Netanyahu in continuing the bombing in Gaza. He has authorized $14 billion of sales and transfers since he has been president. He can simply say to Netanyahu, stop. And then we can convene the Palestinians, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Israel to have a solution in Palestine that does not involve Hamas, that involves the civil voices in Palestine, and finally have a Palestinian state. But the question is whether Trump is going to stand up to Netanyahu's bombing in Gaza, stand up really to Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, who are pushing Netanyahu to continue this, and I really hope that he will, and the Congress can say we don't want to continue to fund it.
Thank you very much for joining us. Congressmember Ro Khanna, Democratic congressmember from Silicon Valley in California, introduced a bipartisan Iran War Powers Resolution. Happy birthday to Karen Ranucci. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Something curious, something cultural, something unserious, sometimes serious, something mundane, something everyday, though not even really that. Tune into Typically Tuesdays, airing every Monday. You heard that right, Monday, from 3 to 4 p.m., your hour of quasi-cerebral talk and tunes.
We are diverse.